This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello and welcome to Trumpet Hour. I'm Philip Nice, and this is the Week in Review edition of the show for April 5th, 2024. You might have heard some of our Wednesday replays, but we are recording this on Friday with a focus on what has emerged this week. And our four Philadelphia Trumpet writers have been watching the four corners of the globe. We have Richard Palmer watching Europe.
Good afternoon.
We have Jeremiah Jacques watching Asia.
Good to be with you.
We have Mihailo Zekic watching the Middle East.
Hello there.
And we'll have Andrew Miller covering Anglo-America, the United States, and the related English-speaking nations, Britain, the little nation of Israel. So we're going to take these regions in this order, starting with Mr. Palmer. Can you give us an update on Europe?
One of the big scandals in Germany this week has been an Alternative for Deutschland politician that's been caught accepting money from Russia, or the news propaganda channel linked to Russia. That's put the spotlight on this party's links to Russia. The German police have done an investigation. They found that there are more than 400 investigations into far-right extremist attitudes or beliefs or conspiracy theorists among German officers in state police forces. And that's actually only three-quarters of German states responded to this kind of investigation, so that number is likely to be a lot higher. So that shows quite a large number of far-right attitudes embedded within the German police. That has been a cause of great concern over there. And then one from the UK that I think, you know, ties into this point that you've made, that Society Watch leads to the World Watch and the kind of the geopolitical implications of the breakdown in morality, where a very senior member of the Conservative Party was using the homosexual dating app Grindr. He sent compromising pictures of himself to someone that he met on this dating app. They then turned around and blackmailed him. He handed over a whole bunch of contact details for other MPs who also got contacted. Some of them sent compromising pictures and were then blackmailed. I don't think we know who's behind this. It could be a foreign state actor or anything like that. But you've had this kind of door open for blackmail to Britain's ruling party and government, really, because of perversion at the top of this political party, the supposedly conservative party. And I think the most remarkable part of this story is the person that started this all, using this homosexual dating app, sending pictures of himself, he has not been asked to resign. He is being treated as kind of an innocent victim in this, just doing something that's completely normal. So for Britain's conservative right-wing party, that behavior is not extreme, not beyond the pale, and is just considered a normal thing to do.
You could consider that Society Watch DEFCON 1. I'm reminded of when Melanie Phillips, the great journalist, was here at the Trumpet offices, and she spoke to the staff. And she said, and I think she's written abundantly on this, that one thing that she learned as a journalist is to really do your research, to really dig in and to really find out the facts, which everybody says they do. She actually would read the full report. She would actually do the work. And in doing so, she said one thing that she found that happened repeatedly, and specifically in Britain, in Parliament, is that people's personal lives affected their policy decisions. They would vote on something or advance some sort of bill because they, back at home, you know, they personally were morally compromised. That's a very good illustration of that and a confirmation of that what she said was true. For your main story, you put it in the notes here, and I don't know if you thought this would be what we would lead off with, but I definitely think we need to lead off with it because it's another major factor in something that we've been watching perhaps more than anything else, and it has to do with Germany and its military.
Yes, Germany will be restructuring its military, and I think there's a couple of really crucial points here. One thing that they'll be doing is they'll be creating a new fourth branch of the military. So you'll have the army, you'll have the navy, you'll have the air force, and you'll have cyber command, cyber warfare. You may remember America did this a little bit ago where it was army, navy, air force, and space force. But for Germany, it's cyber. And then the second big thing that they're doing is they're going to kind of restructure the way these four branches work together. And they're going to operate under one central command. Previously, there were two commands. There was this kind of at-home command and abroad command. Now it's all going to be centralized with one general staff. So I think two huge takeaways from this. One is the focus on cyber warfare. Like, if you are making the cyber branch of your military an equal branch with the army and with the navy and the, I don't know anyone that's done this before. That's putting a lot of emphasis on cyber and cyber warfare. That is really showing you that the German military considers that a very high priority. And if you have been a long-time Trumpet reader, I think there are articles that we've written that are just jumping out at you right now. First and foremost of which, this milestone article from Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry, America's Achilles' heel and Germany. He made a point that a lot of people have been making, that America is uniquely vulnerable to cyber warfare and cyber hacking, and that America's reliance on technology makes this a dramatic weakness in a way that it isn't for other countries. And even since then, you've seen, like, when France fought alongside America in Afghanistan, kind of when they went back home, they made a point of trying to unlearn the reliance on technology because they regarded that as a weakness. So that you see in quite a lot of places. But it's the and Germany part that is unique to this article, where Mr. Flurry draws attention to how this fits with the way that Germany has fought in the past, and draws special attention to the role that Germany could play in exploiting this Achilles' heel. So to see this come out of that detail, I think, is remarkable, or this change. And then the other thing is this redesigned German command structure. And, you know, this, when the Allies came together and Roosevelt and Stalin and Churchill signed this document at Yalta that it articulated their war aims, one thing that they drew special attention to, you know, they said, well, we're going to destroy Germany, we're going to destroy German militarism, we're going to get rid of the German army. But one thing they really singled out for more attention in that than just about anything else was the German general staff. And they said that we want to break up for all time the German general staff that has repeatedly contrived the resurgence of German militarism. And I think this is probably influenced most strongly by Winston Churchill, the kind of the real historian among the three there. And he saw the role that the German general staff played, not just in the run-up to World War II, but for many, many years in German military planning, preparedness, attitudes, success. I mean, the Germans were the first, the Prussians were the first to organize their military this way. The German General Staff was the world's first kind of General Staff Corps. And it was set up, I think, unofficially in 1816. It has roots even going back far longer than that into the 17th century. Instead of having all of these very different branches of military intelligence and logistics, and then you get into the modern era and you've got an air force and you've got an army and you've got all of these different things that need to work together, the German general staff puts together this machinery that tries to help all of that work together and take all the best bits from all of these and produce well thought through, well-rounded battle plans. And it was because of their success, the culture, the professionalism that they instilled, that then come 1945, it was said, well, we're going to break them up. And as it said, they're for all time. And even when the Allies kind of backtracked on this commitment to Germany not having a military in 1955 and West Germany was allowed to have an army, the German general staff kind of ban remained in place. And it was a military without a general staff. They didn't have one in a way that just about every other modern military at the time did. And over time, that has loosened. And they have had in the last couple of decades, something kind of coming closer to being a typical general staff. But, you know, we don't know all the details on this joint staff yet. From Pistorius, he's given the broad outline yesterday in his announcement, but I think we're still waiting to see exactly how big is it going to be and what the org chart might look like and that kind of thing. But this definitely seems a step back towards this typical way of doing things with a competent professional general staff at the heart of events. And he talked about how the reason for doing this is so that the German army can be more nimble, so that they can respond more quickly, deploy abroad more quickly. So this is quite a radical restructuring of the German military, but it is a radical restructuring right in line with the things that we've been watching for from Germany.
What Mr. Palmer is bringing you here is so important. And as I was listening to you, I thought this is even more important than I was thinking. the context you're bringing and the history there, I mean, here's what I think. I think when they write the history books, this will be in there. These types of changes to turn the German military back into the superpower force that it has been and can be. I mean, you bring out such a good point about the German general staff. That's the most powerful commanders over the entire military, all branches of the military, as you say, working together and maximizing the potential force of the military. I mean, talk about organization. They've been organizing the militaries or units of other militaries from other European nations under the German military, under German commands. They've been coming to agreements for building weapons platforms, the main battle tanks, I think you were mentioning. There's the 100 billion euro fund, the purchase of the F-35s, nuclear war gaming, and this absolute dynamo of a defense minister, Boris Pistorius, that you mentioned. I see a trend in Germany. I see a trend in the German military specifically that whatever else is going on, there is something happening. Now, it's been weak. I mean, it has been weak. They've had some issues, some embarrassing issues, but it is not trending weaker. It's trending much, much stronger.
It is. And I think these are just some of the biggest. We will write on this and we'll get into more of the details, but even there's a lot of tweaks that get rid of the kind of some of the last vestiges of the legacy of World War II, say, and its restraint on the German military. So another one, for example, for the longest time, the German military has not had the ability to command troops at home. They've tried to quite deliberately carve that out and make that still under the defense force, but it's a little bit separate, this kind of homeland security force. They're separate from the armies. Homeland security forces will now be the army's responsibility. All of these changes, there are all the changes of removing the safeguards, say, that were put on there. Most of those safeguards, probably 95% of the safeguards are gone, but say the 5% are left. Then it's not a coincidence that that is what is now toppling. It's a determined push to make Germany a kind of a normal military. Or I enjoyed the Google Translate of Boris Pistorius's announcement, where in there it says, for example, this is from his write-up, the current security situation requires a belligerent Bundeswehr. You know, it is all about aggression. Like, it is exactly all of these things that we've been watching for, even down to the details, which I think it was like that command, that cyber warfare that I just find so fascinating. And it really is like America, you know, if you're going after terrorists, even if you're going after Russia, like cyber warfare being the fourth branch of the military, like the KGB uses typewriters so that you can't hack them. That says something about what their ambitions are, that they're making that the fourth branch. So yeah, this is something that is concerning. And I thought you set this up very well when you mentioned this is one of the things that we've probably focused on perhaps more than any other. You can go back to some of the very earliest trumpet issues. I think 1991, for example, is one of those that talks about, well, watch for Germany militarizing. It's one of the most consistent forecasts. You're right, from 1945, Herbert W. Armstrong was saying, well, Germany is going to rise again and become more militaristic. And if for a long time, I think the other thing about this is that it's not big news. I mean, it kind of gets back to the same point that we made in the rundown of short stories. Like, the fact that Germany can do this and remove those safeguards, and it's like page 27 of your newspaper,
right?
Not page one of you, like, nobody cares.
Right.
Not a big deal to the world. Like, so because the world has been crying out for the last 20 years for Germany to do this. Like, if there's any response, the response from outside of Germany is about time.
Right.
To give credit to the Germans, this will probably be more controversial within Germany than within America or Britain. So we've forgotten about it. We don't care. But Mr. Armstrong warned, Mr. Flurry has warned, based on these prophecies in the Bible, that you're going to see this beast power arise in Europe. And it's described in Revelation 13. It's described in Revelation 17. And people look at that and say, well, who is likened to this power? Who is able to make war with him? It's a great war-making power. And we've had a series of fantastic articles very recently. One as recently as Wednesday in our Trumpet Brief from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry, pointing to some of these major events. That one was Rising from the Underground Rheinmetall, where Germany is a defense industry powerhouse. It's leading Europe. France has a pretty big defense industry. all of this is coming together already. There's a lot of pieces in place already for Germany to rise as this military powerhouse. The Bible says that it's going to happen. And this lays the groundwork now for a rapid fire military that responds like a whirlwind, that is able to strike very quickly. And this is what we've been warning for this for decades. And what you're seeing matches exactly the shape and the contours of what we've been outlining for decades, because it's being based on Bible prophecy. So it's dramatic proof that these Bible forecasts, when Mr. Fleury said, well, Germany's going to watch for cyber warfare, that was based on a specific prophecy in the book of Ezekiel. Like, all of these things have been based on the Bible, and what you're seeing matches those contours exactly.
You suddenly find yourself in this, who is like unto this power? Who can make war with this power? Where you suddenly find yourself at the point where there's nothing you can do. You're facing this unstoppable hurricane that's coming at you digitally, that's coming at you with weapons of mass destruction, that's coming at you with political and diplomatic power, and there's nothing you can do. And you wonder at that point, how did we get to this? Well, it's weeks like this. It's decisions like this that build up to a sum of its parts that cannot be stopped. So you've got to watch, as the Trumpet has been exhorting you to watch since the 90s, as you bring out, as the Plain Truth has been exhorting you to watch since the 40s, you've got to watch what's happening in Germany, not so you can craft some sort of diplomatic policy to stop the Germans, but so that you can understand that there's something going on with Bible prophecy, and there's something going on with the Plain Truth explanation of Bible prophecy and the Trumpet, Philadelphia Trumpet explanation of Bible prophecy. Let's go on to the next region that Bible prophecy exhorts us to watch, which is the Eastern region. Jeremiah Jacques, you have been covering Asia. What's the rundown?
First, there was a major earthquake that hit Taiwan on Wednesday. This was Taiwan's most destructive earthquake in about 25 years. 10 people killed, more than 1,000 injured. The nations of the world rushed to send their condolences to Taiwan over this disaster, which is pretty normal in a case like this. But what was not normal was that China said, wait a minute, if Taiwan belongs to me, then those condolences belong to me too. So China's deputy ambassador to the United Nations, he heard those condolences issued for Taiwan, and he jumped up like a cornerback and intercepted them. He said at the United Nations, he said, quote, China thanks the international community for its expressions of sympathy and concern. So, you know, China is claiming not just Taiwan's territory, but also its right to speak on the world stage. And it's very embarrassing, really, to see this, very childish. But it's what we've come to expect from the childish bullies in the Chinese Communist Party. And it does leave me with a question. Does this mean China also plans to cover the cost of rebuilding everything in Taiwan that the earthquake destroyed?
I think they'd happily send over a large force of military age fit males to help with the reconstruction.
We could see that in the near future. Next up, a story about Japan and demographics. Like many people in wealthy countries, the Japanese have stopped having many babies. So their population is shrinking, and they don't have enough people for many sectors of their workforce. So this week, the Japanese government announced that it will admit 820,000 foreigners to come in over the next few years. So this is very big news because Japan has always been leery of letting foreigners move in. Between 2011 and 2016, that's when we had over 1 million Syrian refugees that poured into Europe. And at that time, Japan allowed 7 people to come in. 7 Syrian refugees. So that shows you just how uneasy Japan is about foreigners. And they do have one of the world's most ethnically homogenous societies. About 99% of the people in Japan are ethnically Japanese. And they would like to keep it that way. But now, since their people are not making new Japanese people, they're having to compromise on this cherished value and swing the gates open to foreigners who can fill all these labor vacancies. One other quick one here about China. Yesterday, news broke that in Gaza, the Israeli military has found large caches of Chinese-made weapons that the Hamas terrorists are fighting with. These are grenade launchers, rockets, and a lot of other equipment. They've also found Hamas to be using Chinese intelligence gathering gear. So this is morally repugnant even for the Chinese Communist Party. It shows that there's absolutely no limit to how low they will stoop in order to chip away at the power of America and its allies, such as Israel. absolutely no limit. And it's also the pinnacle of hypocrisy, really, when you think about the way China treats Muslims back at home. You know, the Uyghur Muslims who live in China. The Chinese Communist Party is waging a merciless campaign to subjugate the Uyghurs, to drain their religion of all potency. But in Israel, it's just the opposite. China wants the most radical Islamists to be empowered, armed to the teeth, and China's actually sending the weapons to help them wage their satanic jihad.
Each of those stories we could go on about, but I see from the notes here, you're going to bring us an update on something we recorded a video about. So you could go to thetrumpet.com and look at the video section there. You'll see a video on this topic, but it also caught my eye as another one of these things that doesn't seem important, but it could build into something that's unstoppable. And so we're talking about legislation in Georgia.
Yeah, that's right. The Republic of Georgia, not the state, but they have resurrected a law that could really accelerate Russia's takeover of the country. So Georgia, of course, it's a small nation there in the Caucasus region. And for almost two centuries, it was under Moscow's control, first as part of the Russian Empire, then as part of the Soviet Union. But all of that ended in 1991. The Soviet Union collapsed and Georgia achieved its independence. But Russia has been trying ever since then to restore control over Georgia. We saw that very dramatically in the 2008 war, when Russia conquered a fifth of Georgia's land and made that, you know, de facto Russian territory. And now Russian President Vladimir Putin may want to go even further. And Georgia's ruling party seems ready to help him pull Georgia deeper into Russia's orbit. This new legislation, it's called the Foreign Agent Law, and basically it brands charities and media groups and other organizations that receive a certain amount of funding from the West as agents of foreign influence. And once those organizations are branded that way, it puts them in the crosshairs of Georgia's pro-Russia politicians. And so this law would really sabotage Georgia's attempts to align itself more with Europe. It's, you know, totally anathema, really, in the eyes of Europeans. This goes against their principles. So for this reason, the people of Georgia protested this foreign agent bill in great numbers last year when it was first introduced. The Georgian people overwhelmingly want their country to align with Europe instead of Russia. So they protested vehemently against this pro-Russia law. And those protests last year were enough to force the Georgian government to drop the bill. But now, Russia is using its influence in the Georgian government to resurrect it. And it could be a major move in returning Georgia more completely to Russian control.
It reminds me a bit of what happened during World War II and right after World War II with the communist groups that were in Europe, that Russia, that the Soviet Union back then had contact with. You think about at the end of World War II and Stalin's war machine made it all the way to Central Europe. What did he do with those new territories he acquired? How did he govern them? He had people in those communist parties, supposedly egalitarian, supposedly for workers everywhere, supposedly looking at the interests of their own country. And he installed them as puppet states after he had some of them he had groomed for years, sending them to Moscow to be educated, etc. And then once the war was over, he had a whole entourage of people from these countries that naturally looked to Moscow for leadership, that naturally wanted their positions of power to be used so they could bring their countries into the Russian sphere of influence. These days, communism isn't exactly the ideology that Russia is using, but you still see the same principle in small countries like Georgia, in occupied Ukraine. Even what Mr. Palmer mentioned earlier today about the AFD, I don't think the AFD is going to become a Russian stooge. But still, there's a lot of people there that like the way Vladimir Putin does things, that want to be a part of his world, that if given the chance, if this is how circumstances play out, at least in countries like Georgia, they're willing to become the new East Germans or the new Czechoslovakians of the communist era. And we'll see if Georgia turns into that, but we could see this being a weapon, this soft influence and these international crony populations, if you will, becoming a weapon that Putin could end up using to his favor quite strongly.
Well, I remember 2008 and the headlines, Russian tanks are rolling into Georgia, like old-fashioned World War style warfare. You know, it was just shocking that Putin just did it. You know, he just did it. And you've been covering Asia for a while. And I remember you would cover what Russian forces were doing in Georgia, what they were doing in Ukraine. I remember you writing, you know, these just weekly updates about there's like this creeping invasion going on where they just kept moving their fence posts basically into territory that was not theirs, or they were, you know, in some cases famously, you know, not in marked uniforms, yet they were clearly Russian. Little stories like that that you published week by week over the years have made me understand that maybe it's a good idea to pay attention to what Jeremiah Schock's mentioning, even if at first it seems like, okay, well, there's a fight in the Georgian legislature over some bill, you know, this could lead to something.
Yeah, and some of those, they call that salami slicing, just a little bit at a time, move the fences, but this is a new kilometer that's essentially part of Russia every time they make this move. And I'm glad you mentioned that war back in 2008, because that was only a six-day war, and many people kind of forgot about it very quickly after it happened. But Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury said that that war back in 2008 marked the start of a dangerous new era for the world. That's what he wrote in 2008, just after it happened. And if you look at the 16 years since then, this forecast has really proven correct in one nation after another. 2013, Putin ousted America from Kyrgyzstan and pulled that nation into his orbit. 2014, that's when Russia seized Ukraine's Crimea and really plunged the nation's east into a state of conflict. 2015, he started to position Russia as a lead player in the Middle East, and he used that position to help the murderous Syrian regime stay in power and to help Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons. 2020, Putin ensured that Belarus's dictator remained in power despite a major uprising against him. That effectively turned Belarus into a human rights trampling Russia satellite state. Later in 2020, Moscow stationed thousands of Russian soldiers in Azerbaijan for the first time, really pulled that nation more into his orbit. And then you come to 2022, of course, that's when Russia expanded its war on Ukraine into Europe's most devastating conflict in 25 years. And then we've also seen Putin conspiring with China to undermine the international order, helping North Korea become a stronger nuclear power, propping up Venezuela's dictator while that nation bleeds, working with Germany to increase both nations' power over their neighbors. And the list goes on and on. So Mr. Fleury said that that Russian invasion of Georgia back in 2008 was a turning point. And he said that was just the start of the violence and just the start of a dangerous new era. And time has proved that he was right. And the reason is because that forecast was based on Bible prophecy.
When you rattle off the timeline like that, it's stunning. And I know you didn't even cover everything. Like you said, you could go on and on about different legal things that have happened and then outright warfare that has happened, be it long or short. Putin has shown he's capable of a six-day war and he's capable of ongoing grinding, how is this happening in the modern world type of war in Ukraine. He's willing to send aircraft carrier to, you know, to the Middle East, I think it was. He is a force. And he came to power, if I remember right, in 2000 at first. And he's been there for more than two decades and single-handedly just changed the calculus of what Russia can do and is doing in the world.
Yeah, he's made some dramatic transformations. When he came into power, Russia was in a state of extreme turmoil, economic dysfunction, political dysfunction. He set to work really restoring its place on the world stage, and he truly has steered the world into a more dangerous new era. And if anyone would like to understand the prophecies that Mr. Fleury's forecast are built on, I would recommend that they order a free copy of his booklet. It's called The Prophesied Prince of Russia.
That's The Prophesied Prince of Russia. That's a remarkable booklet, a remarkable claim to make, not only that Bible prophecy is true, but that it's so specific and so pegged to a certain time frame. In this case, a certain man, that you can prove it from world headline news, and you can connect world headline news to the Bible through this booklet and looking into the Bible yourself. As you mentioned there, that's The Prophesied Prince of Russia. We've hit Europe, we've hit Asia, and we'll hit the Middle East and Anglo-America when we come back here on Trumpet Hour Week in Review.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Welcome back, Trumpet Hour listeners. Thanks for staying with us. We have covered Europe and Asia. Now we're going to cover the Middle East. Mihailo Zekic, give us a rundown of the top stories in the Middle East this week.
Interestingly enough, every single one of my stories, including the main one, happened last Monday, which coincided with an ancient pagan equinox festival we call April Fool's Day. I don't know if there's any link, but April 1st was the deadline everybody was watching for the Israeli coalition to fall because of what we talked about last week, the exemption for Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox Jewish students to be drafted in the military. But nothing too much has happened because of that, and I don't think it will for at least another few days because there's so much else that's happening on that specific day. That day, Iraq launched a drone strike on the port of Eilat, which is on Israel's southern shore, the Gulf of Aqaba, the northern tip of the Red Sea there. Iraq is fairly far away from Israel. They had to send their drone across Jordanian airspace, and most likely the Jordanians didn't see that coming because they probably would have warned Israel, across Israeli airspace to hit this building in the naval base. Thankfully, nobody apparently was hurt. But it goes to show how much power the Iran-backed militias in Iraq are getting, and it may be a hint as to their involvement in the wider Islamist war against Israel in the future, even though they technically don't even have a border with Israel. That same day, an Israeli strike in Gaza killed 7 workers with the World Central Kitchen humanitarian group, which has caused Israel a lot of flack and has even gotten some firings happening in the IDF. Israel also launched a strike in Damascus in what the world is saying is an Iranian diplomatic compound. What Israel is saying is a terrorist training center. It's probably both. And killing Mohammad Reza Zahedi, who was the Quds Forces, shall we say, Lebanon, Israel, Levant operations guy in charge. Iran did not take this lightly. Apparently, the rest of the world was blindsided by this. They're threatening retaliation, but some anonymous Iranians have told Reuters that it's going to be limited and something that they hope won't escalate. And they probably do not want Israel to be getting more involved in that part of the world, especially kicking Hezbollah and Iran out of Lebanon. All of Israel's holding their breath for that. We'll see what happens with that in the next few days. Apparently, among those blindsided was the United States government, who in the form of the United Nations, that venerable bastion of keeping Israel safe, I speak as a fool, said that they had no idea that this was happening, that Israel did not inform them, and they asked Iran quite publicly not to attack their forces in retaliation, which a silent part out loud is that if they attack Israel, that's not that big of a red line. Another little jab from the current occupant of the White House to the state of Israel that way.
You get a sense that the United Nations and tragically the United States, under the guidance of the current occupant of the United States and whoever's controlling him, that the goal is not to, okay, find out what the true humanitarian situation is in Gaza, not to mention Israel, where they're still mourning their dead, and then supply the innocent people with what they need and let the warfare continue between Hamas, which wants warfare, and Israel Defense Forces. Like, that's how everybody's describing it, but that's not logical. It does not make sense for the United States to be doing what it's doing and the United Nations to be doing what it's doing if all they care about is the humanitarian situation in Gaza, and I would add the humanitarian situation in places that border Gaza and have fresh graves from October 7th. What's the main story that we can focus in on for the Middle East region this week?
Well, Israel is on the cusp of getting rid of another one of its enemies, and possibly for good. And this time it's a foreign enemy, but it's one that's been operating domestically for a long time. And I'm talking about the news agency from the Gulf state of Qatar, Al Jazeera. Anybody that has been around long enough may have Al Jazeera in the mind as this infamous Arab-sponsored paper that keeps saying anti-Israel, anti-American stuff. They've done a lot to reform their image, including being able to operate an office in Jerusalem. But as we're going to talk about, they've done quite a lot of fishy stuff, and Israel is finally clamping down on them. They passed a law basically allowing the Israeli government to snuff out any foreign media organizations that they brand a national security threat. And when I say snuff out, I mean they'd be forced to close their shops. They'd be forced to give up their hardware, their material into Israeli custody. And this could only happen with a signing off from a judge, and the permit has to be renewed. So it's not going to be like a blanket ban. But it still is a step in the direction of muzzling Al Jazeera from Israel. Why is this such a big deal? Well, a lot of the rest of the world is crying about how Israel is attacking free speech and freedom of the media.
So as it relates to, and I think you're speaking specifically, at least the reports that we've seen is about Al Jazeera specifically, but it doesn't matter, whichever, right, journalist more broadly. To those particular report, we've seen the reports, and certainly I'm going to refer to Israel for what they may or may not be considering. But if it is true, a move like this is concerning. We believe in the freedom of the press. It is critical. It is critically important, and the United States supports the critically important work journalists around the world do. And that includes those who are reporting in the conflict in Gaza.
That was White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre giving her views on why this is so important. Never mind the fact that the current government of the U.S. is trying to crack down on misinformation and disinformation and that kind of thing. When Israel does it, that's a whole different story, especially when it's from an Arab state that doesn't even recognize Israel. Yet somehow their news organization is allowed to operate in Israel. But that's a whole other can of worms. But Al Jazeera is, I mean, again, you could expect from a country that doesn't recognize Israel. They are notorious for spewing anti-Israel propaganda, painting the Palestinians and in the most positive light possible and Israel in the worst possible light possible. They recently released an October 7th documentary about a couple of weeks ago on YouTube where they seem to spend more time talking about a handful of friendly fire cases on October 7th when Israel was scrambling to figure out what was going on than the actual hundreds of people that Hamas killed. Basically putting more blame on Israel to what happened than Hamas almost, or at least the attitude. That's not the whole story on why this law is going through. That's certainly a decent part of the story, but Al Jazeera is not just a propaganda mouthpiece. They are actively helping out Hamas. And when I say actively helping out Hamas, I mean the Israeli intelligence community says it has evidence that Al Jazeera has been informing Hamas about Israeli military positions before anything happens so they can get ready. And there's even been Al Jazeera journalists that are terrorists in Hamas that are literally gun-toting soldiers, including one of the commanders of the October 7th invasion, was an accredited Al Jazeera journalist. And not just Hamas, too. Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the other terror group we sometimes mention on here. They are literally helping out terrorism. Al Jazeera, as far as I'm concerned, even as far as news media goes, if you think of some other groups like Russia Today or some of these other more controversial government mouthpieces, Al Jazeera is in a league of its own. If it's letting its own reporters fight as terrorists in Hamas, of all places, what do you call that? If that's not a national security threat, I don't know what is. And this is a lot more well-known than you'd suspect. If we know about it, I can be 100% confident the White House knows about it and a lot of other people know about it, or at least have the ability to easily find out about it. And the fact that they're giving all this flack about Israel's misinformation, disinformation war, when that's exactly what they're doing, shows that this isn't about Al Jazeera. This is, again, another excuse to attack Israel.
I wanted to jump in really quickly and just mention that some analysts, such as Ian Bremmer with G-Zero Media, they've said that this ban by Israel is ill-advised. They've said that it's a sign that Israel's democracy is not in a healthy state. But what I haven't seen them mention is that Egypt, the Arab Republic of Egypt, also banned Al Jazeera. This was back in 2013 that Egypt banned it on grounds that Al Jazeera was, quote, inciting violence that led to the deaths of Egyptians. And then Bahrain and Iraq have also put bans on Al Jazeera.
Really?
So, yeah, I mean, in recent years, we've all seen the power of misinformation and disinformation in the internet age, the way it can convince populations that a certain situation is too murky to really determine which side is right or wrong. You know, propaganda, calling good evil, calling evil good, it can have a profound impact on public opinion. And Al Jazeera blatantly supports terrorism. It is in a league of its own, as Mihailo just said there. Even Muslim-majority nations like Egypt and Iraq and Bahrain recognize that and take action against it. So I think for Israel to recognize that Al Jazeera poses a threat to its national security and to take action against that is a sound move.
I think that's just such a good perspective. And I was about to say that, you know, we are in this war of words, this war of information, this war over deception. And on the one side, yes, we want freedom of speech. We don't want to give the government strong control over what the people can find out. We just talked about Georgia and its foreign-funded organizations and things like that being a concern to the West and to Russia. There's a war there. There's a struggle there over information, what people can know. This shows me that we are way past where we used to be, where we could fight over just the words. When Al Jazeera journalists are arming themselves and are participating in terrorism and Israel can't fight it except with a clampdown like this that presumably could apply to other organizations as well. Yes, it does restrict freedom of speech, but it's kind of like I feel about this country. We're not going back. At this point, it's not about human freedoms. It's more about human survival. And it's not looking good for the latter even.
Yes, the reason I think this is important is because Israel has a lot of enemies that maybe people don't think of as enemies. Iran's the one that gets all the headlines, but there's a lot more other people that want Israel gone, including, in this case, a Gulf state, a so-called moderate Gulf state. There's a prophecy in Psalm 83 that we talk about every now and then on this show that speaks of a group of nations in the Middle East coming together that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. And our editor-in-chief said that, well, Iran says it wants to wipe Israel off the map. These countries seem to have an even greater hatred. And no, history, both in the Bible and in secular sources, shows no sign of this of these particular peoples ever coming together or for this particular purpose. So he said it as a prophecy. Specifically, he mentions the Ishmaelites, or what we would call the Arabs of the Arabian Peninsula. The big fish in there, of course, is Saudi Arabia. But countries like Qatar are part of that same sphere as well. Other countries mentioned, like Saudi Arabia, that we talked about in this program before, like some of these other Gulf states, the UAE, they may be on more friendlier terms with Israel at the moment. We don't expect that to last. And for countries like Qatar, wherever Qatar specifically fits into this is unknown at this point. But the fact that you have one of these countries, one of these Arab states already trying to wipe out Israel shows you that that prophecy is starting to take hold. And it won't be too long before these attitudes start spreading throughout the Arab world.
I remember when Mr. Fleury began emphasizing that there's an alliance of nations in a psalm in the Bible. A lot of Christians appreciate the psalms. Some of them carry around the psalms. And yet there's Bible prophecy even in the psalms. It's really an interesting and intriguing fact.
If our listeners would like to learn more, I'd recommend they order a free copy of our editor-in-chief's booklet, The King of the South, at thetrumpet.com. That's The King of the South. If they'd like to learn more about Qatar specifically and how they've been putting their tentacles in through all sorts of terrorist shenanigans, I recommend reading an article on our website, A Sponsor of Terrorism, America's New Close Friend.
And that's The King of the South and the article, A Sponsor of Terrorism, America's New Close Friend, at thetrumpet.com. That's Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. Now we go to the nations of Anglo-America. Andrew Miller, what's the update?
Yeah, in Anglo-America this week, Bloomberg News has concluded that the United States debt-to-GDP ratio is an unsustainable path, so congratulations to them for that. An elderly South African farmer was beaten bloody by six armed raiders in one of the latest in what's been just a horrific rise in farm attacks over the last several decades in that country. And Scotland has actually made a criminal offense punishable by up to 7 years in prison to stir up hate against a protected identity group.
That information war, right? I mean, it's everywhere, like fighting over what people can know and what people can say. That last one, Scotland, that's been big news this week, where Police Scotland, I think, is what they call the law enforcement up there. And they are trying to get out these public service announcements and promotional campaigns to get people to report each other for hating other people. And the national government is going to discern the hearts of men and decide what hatred is and put people in prison. It's been a big controversy up there. And we are in world information war. right now? What's the main story?
Actually, well, my main story is about the world information war in many ways. The so-called deep state, or the bureaucratic administrative state here in the United States, is really going after both Donald Trump and Elon Musk right now, trying to seize a good bit of their assets. And that's something I wanted to talk about. I'm trying to get like a little bit more of an international perspective on this show. And I know occasionally we get listeners complain that we talk about Donald Trump too much. But I do want to like really focus on this one, is because both Trump and Musk, and it's not just about really their personalities, right, but so much the fact that Donald Trump and Elon Musk are very different men. They're similar in two big ways, though. One, they're both really, really rich, like both on the top 500 list. They also both own a major social media company that promotes free speech. Donald Trump made a few billion dollars last week on his Truth Social, and then Elon Musk owns Twitter. And so you could see how all these people in the information war really hate these two guys, because they're letting people just get up and express their views and looking for ways to penalize them. There's this editorial in the Epoch Times this week. It's titled "Deep State Goes After Trump and Musk, Who's Next?" But their opening sentence is "America as we know it over. Are we in the middle or perhaps the end of a transition from a national republic to a single party regime that rules by fiat instead of law?" And so, warning that the fact that, like, if you can just punitively punish someone like Trump or Musk for promoting free speech in a way that's not legal, if that trend continues, it's like, who's next? Well, you're going to be next. Where like, they can seize like your assets for making free speech arguments that they don't like. And the details here, New York Attorney General Letitia James, she's basically accused Trump of overvaluing his real estate to obtain loans. And then shockingly come to the conclusion that because he overvalued his real estate to obtain loans, that the profits he made from those loans are forfeit, and is now trying to seize like $345 million of his assets. The Epoch Times editorial makes the very salient point that the loans he took were not like from some poor old widow woman or something like that. They were from Deutsche Bank. And so Deutsche Bank lent him hundreds of millions of dollars using a property as collateral, which, using standard banking practice, the bank is the one that sends out the assessors to make sure that the property you put up as collateral is acceptable to them. So Trump put up property as collateral. Deutsche Bank accepted the collateral. He took a real estate loan, made a real estate deal. The real estate deal went through like he wanted it to go through, and he made a bunch of money. No one was hurt here. Trump made money. Deutsche Bank got the money back. It's just a radical leftist attorney general who campaigned for office on the pledge that she was going to be tough on Trump, went back and figured that they're like, okay, the New York Attorney General's office don't think the property was worth that, so it doesn't matter what the people lending the money said. Because it's one of those cases like where really it's like, if Trump said it was worth that much and Deutsche Bank said it's okay, then why is the New York Attorney General's office involved with this at all? Unless you're trying to make a point that this man's standing against for free speech and other things in America that they don't like, and they're trying to make an example of him. Similar case with Elon Musk. I don't know the details of that case as well, but I know the board of Tesla had authorized a record-making $56 billion payout to Elon Musk, which the board of directors approved. And then a Delaware judge tossed it out, saying that they said the amount of money is too much. Musk can't take that. And even though the board of directors approved it, the Delaware court system wants to overrule the board of directors because they said, well, Musk owns too much stock in that company. Therefore, he has too much leverage over the board of directors. And so, like I said, I actually don't know the exact details of this case as well as I know the Trump case, but it is kind of a similar story where Trump took a loan, Deutsche Bank approved the loan, the New York Attorney General's office came back and said, you have to give up all the profits from that real estate deal because we don't like what Deutsche Bank decided the property was worth. This one where Musk asked for a payout from Tesla. The board of directors approved the payout, and a Delaware judge came in and said, it's like, well, it's like you have too much influence over the board of directors. We need the state of Delaware, where Musk doesn't live and Tesla is not headquartered, to come in and tell you whether this payout is legitimate or not. And so the Epoch Times, at least, was making the point that, like, it's like it's almost coincidental that, like, these two big cases of judges just getting involved in business deals against two people who are very famous worldwide for promoting free speech. You do have to think that it looks like just a naked attempt to, like, say that, like, if you stand against the censorship industrial complex, we're coming for your bottom line. The Epoch Times article that said deep state goes after Trump and Musk financial assets. Who's next? Saying that, like, are we moving from a national republic where business people can conduct transactions in a free and fair market to one where judges can come in and really overrule cases where not even many people were complaining because they want to make a political point. The article we have in the show notes is America's Broken Judgment by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, that just talks about deep corruption in the American court system. It actually cites a prophecy in Micah 3, verse 9, where it says, "Hear this, I pray you, you heads of the house of Jacob, and you princes of the house of Israel, that abhor judgment and pervert equity." So he's talking about, like, Jacob and Israel. These are prophetic names for the United States and Britain and the end time. Talking about just deep corruption in the court system. Well, yeah, the Epoch Times is making that same point here. As, like I said, you've got now where the FBI and the other things are starting to censor what you can watch, hear, and read or on social media and other media platforms. You've got two very rich billionaires who've either, in Elon Musk's case, bought out a liberal social media platform and started opening it up for free speech, or in Trump's case, established his own conservative media platform. The U.S. government, the U.S. State Department doesn't have control over those media platforms. And so if they want to maintain that type of information warfare control, they have to go for the wealth of these people who are too financially independent for them to control.
I think it's a really good point that this is, like, if you were in America right now, this is an attack on you. This is not an attack on Elon Musk or Donald Trump in many ways. Andrew's making the point about attack on what you can say. There's poverty in America, but for the most part, if you're an American listening to this, you are wealthy compared to the rest of the world. You look at standards of living, even compared to Europe, you have a bigger house, you have more income, you were able to afford more luxuries. Why is that? It's because people want to do business in America, because people want to go and set up business headquarters in America, because they know they'll be relatively low tax, but most important of all, because they'll have a level playing field. And that if they build a business and if they store up money and wealth, it will not be targeted by a corrupt government. And it's freer there in the United States, even than Europe, where you look at, okay, every few years, the European Commission is running out of money. And so what do they do? Well, they sue Google. You have these tendacious lawsuits, and you have much more regulation that gets in there and says, you can do this and you can't do this. And if you're a startup, you have to have lawyers to help you navigate all of these things. And America is one of the best places to not have to have all those regulations, not have to have all these legal fees, and then not to be subject, most important of all, to those kind of lawsuits. And so when they're going after Donald Trump and Elon Musk, these two big figures, that's sending a blaring message out to the world that your business is not safe in America anymore. And that you can start a business, you can have these agreements to loan money, but then some judge might pore over every business transaction you've done and come up with some really off-the-wall reason as to why you've broken the law. So this is about your income. This is about your standard of living. This is about the survival of America as a political institution. I mean, that's the other even bigger thing, I think, is this is a symptom of getting after my political opponent is more important to me than morals, than justice, than equality before the law. Getting my political opponent is the most important thing to me. They're like, once you reach that point, you're vulnerable to civil war, let alone kind of the knock-on effects of this. It's as a symptom that's deeply worrying. So this is not about Donald Trump and Elon Musk. This is about everybody in the United States. And because of America, such a large country and wealthy country, everyone around the world.
Are you seeing broken judgment in action? Are you looking at the limits of free governments? Are you looking at the limits of human governments in action right now? Are you seeing Bible prophecy in action? Look at America's broken judgment there at thetrumpet.com, where to date we have free speech to bring you these messages over the air, and they're online at thetrumpet.com. That's America's broken judgment. That is all the time we have for Trumpet Hour Week in Review. We thank our panelists for bringing us these updates from the four main regions of the globe. We're looking forward to hearing from you again next week. Thank you for listening. Email us your thoughts on the program at letters@thetrumpet.com. We do appreciate all that feedback. You can let Andrew know if he hit Donald Trump too much this week or just right. And we want to thank Parker Campbell and Isaac Lorenz for all the technical work that they do to produce the show. We thank you for listening to The Week in Review, and we look forward to being back with you again next week on Trumpet Hour.